1. Starting at verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Here we see the foundation of the human race, the foundation of society, the foundation of all the, basically the infrastructure of the world in these verses. God is the author of the human race, and he's the author of the society in which the human race is to be function. And we'll see here that God made man first, and he created man in his own image. Then he created woman, and created woman in his own image. And they created them for a purpose, for a mission. A mission statement was given to man, and they were to be married and to be fruitful and to multiply and have dominion. They were commissioned to work and subdue the world. I believe they were put into a garden sanctuary, and their mission was to cultivate the garden and expand it until they took the garden sanctuary and it covered the whole world. But you can't do it alone. You'd have to be fruitful and multiply. You'd have to generate more workers with the same mission statement. And as their image bearers of God, they would take the image of God, the glory of God, wherever they would go, represent God over the animal kingdom. It was God, man, woman, children, animals, and they would, in that hierarchical structure of authority, and they would take dominion and work and take the glory of God with them throughout the face of the earth. That's why they exist, for God's glory, for a commission, for work, to subdue the world. In that we see there are certain things that are foundational to society. And I believe this text and the foundation of society is what's being undermined and worked against by social justice. Social justice is seeking to undo, if you would, this infrastructure. Now, in the last couple lessons, we've been talking about how every worldview or system of thought comes down to three ultimate questions and how we answer those questions. And we've concluded that God is the answer to all life's ultimate questions. What is real or what is ultimate? God is. He's the foundation. There's nothing beyond God. There's no turtle underneath God holding God up. He is self-sufficient and eternal. He is the only being that needs no other being for his own existence. Every other being is contingent. So God is the ultimate being that holds up all other beings. How do we know what we know? We know what we know because God has given us a revelation. He's spoken to us in two ways. One, through nature, and two, through his spoken word. That which we know, we have authority. And language has authority because of this. And he's the answer to what and how we're to behave. Here we see that man has purpose. And now think of your life without purpose. Why do you exist? Why am I here? I think that's the question that plagues most people and brings the most depression in their life. And working with people over the years, I've concluded personally, it's my personal opinion. I don't have statistics or facts to back what I'm saying, but I do believe it's true that people are depressed for two major reasons. One, they're lonely. It's not good for man to be alone. That sense of loneliness, especially if you don't have God in your life, there's a sense of emptiness in you, and you can feel the emptiness down into your bones, and it's depressing. And you can't get away from it. Everywhere you go, you sleep, you feel it. You wake up, you feel it. Even when you're enjoying the most pleasant thing of life, that underlying emptiness is there. And that is hard. Without God, it's impossible, I believe. The second thing is feeling that life means nothing, and your life in particular means nothing. But see, God is the thing that satisfies life. He is the reason that we exist. And if you have a purpose, you have meaning. And by the way, you have an ethical code of existence. If you have purpose, then you know what you're to do and how you're to do it. And what we'll see is that social justice is undermining God, which takes away everything. So God is the foundation behind the biblical worldview. But let's work through this. Like, there's an infrastructure of society that God has laid. Do you realize that we didn't create marriage? You and I, or some culture, didn't say, hey, let's get married. Let's get men and women and get them married. I mean, why? Have you thought about this? Why do people get married? Why not just date indefinitely? I know in our day there's people do that. And this marriage has been attacked since the beginning with polygamy and all kinds of unbiblical and unnatural types of relations. Infidelity has been raging since the beginning. But we know it's not the way God intended. The design is a man and a woman to be married, and there's an instinct to that. It's not just, hey, let's just date forever. There's an instinct of two becoming one flesh. But where did that come from? We know that Psalm 119 says that there is a God. He's the ultimate reality. We know in Romans 120 that we know this ultimate reality because He's revealed this to us. And we know in Romans chapter 2 that we have the law written in our conscience. And this is kind of the foundation of society, that God is the divine authority. And language itself is authoritative because it can be rooted back in God. It can be traced back to original source. There's a divine dictionary. It's the standard. God sets the standard of the dictionary. And we can't just say, well, language is subjective and culturally constructive altogether, even though there is some element of truth to that. No matter what language you're from or what region you're from or country you're from and what language you speak, there are certain things that are true that transcends language that we all know. We can all look at the sun, no matter where we're from, and we may call the sun something different or the moon something different. We may have a different word for it, but we have the same concept of a sun, no matter where we live. When you look at things that God created, there's design in the things that He created. And that design is communicating its purpose. It's communicating what God intended it to be used for. So this is the foundation of the Christian worldview. And I believe it's the foundation of society. And you don't have to have the Bible to know these things. These ultimate truths God has universally communicated in nature. Psalm 19, Romans chapter 1, and so forth. These are things that are universal truth, and we know it. And if we start chipping away at these universal truths, the whole our whole worldview will crumble into absurdity, and society will follow along with it. So this is very practical stuff. It's like, well, it doesn't matter if you believe in God or not. Yes, it does. What you believe will determine how you live. And no wonder Satan hates truth. He hates it because he hates God and he hates authority. And so, what is the basic foundation of the infrastructure of society? Now, this is not for us to create. This is something God has created. And I believe it begins with man being made in the image of God. That is the foundation, is man's made in the image of God. And being made in the image of God elevates us above the animal kingdom. There's something different and unique about man that's not true about animals. And this gives us individual purpose. And wherever you see a purpose, our commission statement. We're to represent God. We're made in His image, and we're to carry that image and represent God in what we do and how we behave. Now, that gives us purpose, but it also gives us meaning, and that gives us value. Our very existence is tied up in the fact that we're made in God's image. If there is a God and we're made in His image, that means we're valuable. Almost priceless. What are we value? What is our value? Human life is priceless. There's nothing on earth as more valuable than a human soul. Because we alone are in God's image. And that, so that gives us, think about what that gives us. It gives us purpose. It gives us an ethical standard, what we're to live for. Sin is coming short of the glory of God, coming short of our divine purpose. You're made for this. And when you don't give God glory in all that you do and think and say, you're coming short for the reason you're created. If you're not working hard and taking dominion, you're coming short of what and the reason God made you. So you have purpose, but it also gives you a responsibility. Wherever you see purpose, you see responsibility. You see something you have to do. You have to be. You have to be God's image bearers. You have to represent God. That's why you exist, why God created you. And that gives you rights. Purpose or responsibilities gives you rights. Now think about this. You are made in God's image, and God directly tells you how to live and how to behave. Now that means you have a responsibility. But wherever you see a responsibility given to you by a higher authority, God says do this, now I have the responsibility to do that. Wherever you see that responsibility, you also see a right. I have the right to do this. And you can't, no one can tell me I can't do that. Because God told me I got to do that. No other person or no other authority, no other entity, Satan or any other, your husband or your wife or government, no one can say to you, do not represent God. No, God, because God has given you that responsibility. And where you see responsibility, you see rights. And your freedom, the freedom of individualism, the freedom that you have personally comes from God, not from the state. Remember that. We don't get our rights through the governments. We get our right from God because there's a responsibility that God has placed upon us. There's no freedoms without responsibilities. Never forget that. If you have a freedom, you have a responsibility. If you have a responsibility, you have freedom. The world wants freedom without responsibilities. That's called sin, which is going to kill you. But with God, there's a command, there is freedom with commands. Because it comes from God. And I have the right and I have the freedom to do it. I have the liberty to do what God tells me to do. And I must do it, but I'm free to do it. That's important. And the fundamental right and freedom that we have, because we're made in the image of God, we have the right to life. The right to life, the right to live, not just to live for ourselves, but the right to live for the glory of God. And our life, if our life represents God and we're made for God, we have the right to live and we have the freedom to live, the freedom to preserve our own life. That's the foundation of society. Once we forget that the right to life is the foundation of society, that everything's going to crumble. But I promise you that's what Satan is trying to undermine. It's trying to promise you individual freedom through sin. License to sin. Do what you want to do. Irrespective of God, get God out of the equation and just live for yourself. That's the message of Satan. But that's going to destroy your life. And it does destroy life. And it doesn't bring liberty and freedom. It brings bondage, and corruption, and death. But once we understand the freedom of life, the right to live from the womb to the grave, to our gray hairs, our deathbed, we have the right to preserve life. And we must preserve life. Then that gives us not only the right to live, but it gives us a responsibility towards others. We're free to protect our own life, and we're to take dominion, which means we're responsible to work and provide for our lives. that we must do what we can to preserve our life. And then that gives us an ethical code of how to treat one another. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So it's our right to live and our right to preserve the life of others. In fact, we do not have the right to take the rights of others. That's why we have the Ten Commandments. And so all of a sudden, God is laying kind of the infrastructure of how humanity is to relate to one another and to build society and interact. And it's all built upon the fact that we're made in the image of God. The right to life protects all other rights. The right to work and provide for one's family. The right to marry, for a woman to marry a man to marry a woman. To raise a family. In fact, even a responsibility to raise a family. To be fruitful and to multiply and take dominion. There's the right to worship God. If we're made for His glory, then we have the freedom and the right to worship God according to our conscience. And no one can take that away. Government has no authority to take that away. No one can. Church cannot do that. So this is one of the things to see. Your individual freedoms and rights are directly communicated to you and delegated to you by God Himself. There's not an intermediary authority over that individual rights. Even wives are not under their husbands in the sense that they get their right to life through their husband. No. Men and women are both equally made in the image of God, and God directly gives the rights to men and directly gives the rights to women. He directly gives every individual, as many individuals there are in the human on this globe, God is directly connected to each one of them and says, you have the right to live for my glory. You have the freedom to live for my glory. You have the responsibility to live for my glory. And no husband or no other delegated hierarchical structure of authority can undermine that. Now, he does put some hierarchical structure of authority, but that doesn't violate that God directly rules over the individual and the conscience of the individual. Now, never forget that, because that's the foundation of society. And underneath that, the individual rights, you have the rights of families. That God instituted the family unit. He's designed it that man should not live alone. And He wanted man to be fruitful and to multiply, because you can't cultivate this globe with the glory of God and take dominion and take the garden sanctuary to the four corners of the world without help. We're not omnipresent. Adam and Eve, they were designed to live forever before the fall, but they couldn't be everywhere. But how are you going to multiply the image of God and image bearers? By being fruitful and multiplying, by producing helpers and workers, and together we would be fruitful and multiply, and the design of creation, if there was no sin, was to fill the whole earth with the glory of the glory and the knowledge of God through the image bearers of God. And then the whole earth would be filled with the knowledge and the glory of God through God, God's people, God's children, God's image bearers. So here we see that men and women are made to marry, and in this institution that God directly established, God directly oversees, and God directly governs what it is and gives the marriage unit its own rights and responsibilities. Every time I do marriage counseling, I have to explain. I want to explain to the young couple, the future couple. Like, I always ask the question, why do you want to get married? Why don't you just date forever? And I ask them another question. What do you intend to do in marriage? What's the purpose? What's your mission statement? Why marriage? And I want them not to say, well, we just love each other and we can't live without each other. That's all good and fine. But what I really want them to think about is, why did God establish marriage? And what's the purpose of marriage? And are we going to be on the same page to carry out that purpose? Because wherever you see purpose, you see rights and responsibilities. Or you see a responsibility, you see rights. I got to do this. And that's where your freedoms come from these responsibilities. So men and women have the right to marry. No other powers or institutions can say you cannot do this. You have the right to bear children and have children to multiply. You have the right and the freedom to raise your children. Now that's going to be, social justice is going to try to take that away from you. That's not your right. That's, children don't belong to you. It takes the village to raise your children. It takes the community. Your children are not anyone's possessions. They'll say that's barbaric to have children under the possession and leadership of their parents. The right of husbands to lead, provide, and protect his family. The very institution of the family is designed by God, and the family gets that rights and freedoms not from the government. Government can't redefine marriage. God doesn't honor that redefinition. He doesn't acknowledge that definition. Only God honors his marriage, and he says what God joins together, let no one put us under. God is the one who institutes marriage and sanctions it and provides its responsibilities and freedoms. And then God has established civil authorities. We can go through Romans 13, and for the sake of time, I know you know that passage, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, and we're to pay taxes, submit, because God has established these authorities over us. These authorities were established directly by God. So you have, in society, you have three major institutions. And he delegated authority out, where he didn't put all authority in the individual, all authority in the government, all the authority in the family. Thankfully, he's in his wisdom, in his goodness, he says, okay, you have authority, you have authority, you have authority. And these authorities get their authorities not from one another. They're not stacked on top of one another. That's a hierarchical structure of authority. And I do believe there is that. Like in the family, you have the husband and the wife and the children. So there is hierarchical structure of authority in some sense. But in the three institutions, they don't stack on top of one another. The family's not under the state. The state's not under the family. The individual's not above the state, or the state underneath the individual. They're evenly dispensed. And you got jurisdiction, you got jurisdiction, you got jurisdiction. And this is a balance of power that protects us and is important. But this is how society is to function. I think it's part of natural revelation, and we know it intuitively. You don't need the Bible reaffirms it, but we know it intuitively through creation, God's revelation in creation. And so with these three institutions of power, we have responsibilities to each, but they're distinct. All three underneath the authority of God. Now, sadly, social justice is wanting to unravel all of that. You unravel God at the top, all these other powers or institutions fall apart. Now, social justice calls these institutions of power. And there's some truth to that, because they're delegated authorities. You as an individual, you have power delegated to you by God. You have a responsibility, you have a freedom, and you have the, especially before the fall, right? Before sin entered into it, you had the power, or the liberty, the power, and the ability to perform your responsibility. Now, we know because of sin, we no longer have the moral ability to carry out what God's told us to do, but we still have the responsibility to do it, even though we can't do it. But as being regenerated by the Holy Spirit, then we've been given, through the grace of God, we've been given the power to carry out what God has told us to do more perfectly. And so these three institutions, individual, family, state, or government, civil authorities, they all are institutions of delegated authority or delegated power. Now remember, according to critical theory, power is oppression, because it's authority. last night in our family worship, we were just reading a passage of scriptures, and it talked about the degradation of the times when people wouldn't be lovers of self. And it said the phrase that stood out to me because of these lectures was the phrase that says they, because of their desire for sensual pleasures, they hate authority. I think that sums up the message of Satan. It sums up the heart of depravity. Man loves sensual pleasures, sin. And because of that, they not only suppress the truth and unrighteousness, they hate authority in anywhere it's found. Authority is evil. Authority is oppressive. Especially if authority is telling you you can't do that. That's wrong. That's oppressive. It brings forth what they would say false guilt and internal confliction with self. And that's where all my misery comes from, is from of powers of institutions trying to keep me suppressed, trying to keep me bound to some higher authority. And this is the heart of critical theory, which has bred into social justice. Robin DiAngelo is one of the leading ladies today goes on tour, speaks at all these big events like Coca-Cola, and teaches these classes on diversification and racial sensitivity. And she's the woke police. She's writing all these books. And she wrote, "A critical approach to social justice refers specifically, theoretically, perspective that recognizes that society is stratified, divided, and is divided unequally in far-reaching ways among social group lines that include race, class, gender, sexuality, and ability. Critical social justice recognizes inequality as deeply embedded in the fabric of society and actively seeks to change it." And at the heart of the divisions of people and the unequally privileged people and underprivileged people is based in the infrastructure of power that governs these divisions. Now, the foundation of social justice, as we've seen, can be traced back to Marxism. Then it can get into critical theory. Critical theory kind of is social Marxism. It's trying to get rid of the absolutes that govern our science that used to govern Marxism. Like, let's just get rid of science because, or at least the hardcore objective truths of science, because that still is binding. So let's get to complete relativism. And if you get into relativism, that destroys language. DiAngelo says critical theory developed in part as a response to the presumed superiority and infallibility of scientific method, and raise questions about whose rationality and whose presumed objectivity underlines the scientific method. So Robin DiAngelo is saying, listen, science seems to be binding. You know, you're a male, you're a female, and all these things that science wants to tell us. And who's the scientist? What scientist is there to tell us that that's what the evidence says? So it begins to question the absolutes of science. DiAngelo says, "We know that knowledge evolves over time and is dependent upon the moment in history and the cultural reference points of a society that accepts it." Again, the science and the medicine of 200 years ago is not necessarily the science and the medicine of today. Things change. So it's all relative, she is basically saying. In his famous book, Rules for Radical, Saul Alinsky says, "Men have always yearned for and sought direction by setting up religions, inventing political philosophies, creating scientific systems like Newton's, or formulating ideologies of various kinds." I mean, he's critiquing Newton's laws, which are really just the laws of science. "This is what is behind the common cliche, getting it all together, despite the realization that all values and factors are relative, fluid, and changing. and that it will be possible to, it's not possible to get it all together. That term is only relative. So Saul Alinsky is basically saying there's no truth. And if you say there are, then you're the problem. I have a friend, one of our men in our church is in the military, and they're having training. They're in the military, and they're learning. He said in their training, they're learning the most dangerous people in the world. And this is what one of the phrases they said in the military training. He's in the Air Force. Is the ideology that are statements that say it's true. Truth claim statements. Those who believe in truth claim statements are the most dangerous people in the world, because they're the ones who are going to be willing to fight for something. And, you know, my friend says, is that an absolute truth that you say that? And turned it back on them. And then he asked, why do we fight? Why are we in the military and fighting then if we don't believe in something ourselves? But it's based upon relativism. It's based upon that truth is oppressive, or facts are oppressive, or language itself is oppressive if used without it being subjective and fluid. Robin DiAngelo says, understanding knowledge is a socially constructed, uncovers the role of ideology in the construction of history. For example, the idea that progress is the result of a rational, objective, and value-neutral process, one that is removed from any political agenda, a product of reason alone. This picture of progress supports the belief that there is an objective truth that belongs to the West, and that this truth can be applied universally. This notion of objectivity was central to the rationalization of the colonization and the exploitation of other lands and peoples that belong in the 15th century. So basically the problem is this idea that we can know the truth. Saul Alinsky says, they hate the establishment of the haves with its arrogant opulence, its police, its courts, its churches, justice, morality, law, and order. All these are mere words when used by the haves, which justify and secure their status quo. See what he's saying? For those who say, we want law and order, that's just these people that have, those who have power are using these words, law and order, justice. They're using that to keep the oppressed oppressed. Listen to this. D'Angelo says, consider the first question most people ask expecting parents. Is it a boy or is it a girl? Why don't we ask this question? We ask this question because the answer sets in motion a series of expectations and actions. For example, if parents are informed that they are having a girl, they may begin by buying clothes and decorating the room in preparation for their daughter's arrival. The colors they choose, the toys they buy, their expectations for her future, all will be informed by what the culture deems appropriate for girls. This is the idea that it's the culture that places certain expectations upon girls. It's not anything innately within a girl to act like a girl, and anything innately in a boy to act like a boy. It's just not true. We know that God made men to be men, boys to be boys, girls to be boys, and there are unique differences. And it's not that we impose that upon our children. It's something that comes out of them because God has put it in them. I remember Martin, I'll tell a story on him. When he was just a little tot, able to walk, but he would wobble. I guess he's a toddler, maybe a little bit bigger than a toddler. And he was eyeing this little girl pushing a baby doll around in a stroller. And he's just watching her, and I could tell he wanted to go play with that stroller. And I thought to myself, wow, well, that's kind of a girl activity. I'm like, okay. And he goes over there, and once she leaves it alone, he goes, takes it over, and he's pushing it around. Wait, he gets to it, and he goes into it, and there's a baby doll. He picks it up, the baby doll, throws it on the ground, goes and gets the basketball, puts the basketball in, and pushes the basketball around. And I'm going, that's my boy. But, I mean, who taught him that? Who taught him that? And I'm not saying that boys and girls don't like enjoy the same things. But who's taught girls to be feminine and boys to be masculine? I wasn't there, but Letha said, Britton at the breakfast table this morning, she gave him a napkin. She said, oh, it's girls that are always doing this like this. But us boys, we don't need napkins. You know, and there's something of intuitively different about men and women that is beautiful, that is uniquely designed to be different. But this type of concept is authoritative, they would say. It's oppressive because we're putting boundaries. We're putting our girls in a box. We're putting our boys in a box. We're putting expectations upon them. And that's oppressive. And another characteristic of social justice is that power structures, and we just call it institutions, family, individual rights, family rights, and even civil authorities are inherently oppressive. D'Angelo says, the reality that no one can avoid prejudice because no one can avoid prejudice because it's built into our socialization. Oppression involves institutional control. This is why they call it systemic. Even if you say, hey, I'm not a racist, right? I'm not racist. I've married into a different race. Or ethnicity. I've married into another ethnicity, and I've adopted some children of another ethnicity. I'm not racist. I think we're to love all people equally and be blind to how we treat one another and impartial to rich or the poor, of race. And we treat everyone the same. That's what we would call true justice. Justice where you're blind. You know, the scales, Lady Justice, she's just treating everybody equally according to the law. So even if that's your attitude, doesn't mean you're still not prejudiced and racist because it's built into the infrastructure of society. The family rights, the individual rights, government rights, all these authorities of power are there to keep people oppressed and behaving a certain way. D'Angelo says government is only one institution that men dominate. Men also dominate other major institutions of society, military, medicine, media, criminal justice, policing, finances, industry, higher education, religion, and science. These institutions are interconnected and function together to uphold male dominance across the whole society. So it doesn't matter if a business purposely and intentionally says we're going to hire nothing but females, so that we, you know, that it's not ran by males. She says it's still controlled by males because the institutions that run all institutions are still in place by the males that preceded this business that now only have women. So women are under the dictates of the institutional rules that preceded it. So in social justice, now we saw in Marxism, property, materialism is the ultimate. So thus, who has property or capital? That's where the power of suppression comes from. So we need to get personal property eliminated and divide out things equally. Social justice is basically saying language is powerful. And thus we need to redefine language and make it all relative. I mean, that's critical theory. And social justice, it still adheres to those two things, but it goes on to more minutely says power comes from the majority. It comes from the majority, and it comes not only from that, but it comes from ability. Privilege. Even Rob D'Angelo would say that the world is slanted to favor right-handed people. So left-handed people are oppressed. And it's not fair. It's not fair that they don't have access, easily access to left-handed scissors as readily as right-handed people do. So everybody who in any way has a disadvantage is oppressed by that disadvantage. And society will not be just. So it's not about treating people equally. It's about everything being dispersed equally. The best way I could see the distinction between biblical justice and social justice is looking at sports. And it's amazing, and the Razorbacks have in all their football field, their basketball court, they have the word equality written on it. And what they mean by that is not what they demonstrate on the court. They disregard what their message is. What they want is that there's no privileges. It's not fair for a rich person to pass on his inheritance to his children and the children to be born with silver spoons in their mouth, because there's going to be some children that are born underprivileged, right, without those resources. And so that's an injustice. That's inequality. And there's so much inequality because there's rich, there's poor, there's some people who are have more ability, some people have better health, other people are handicapped, some people are right-handed, some people are left-handed. And, you know, then you have the different all kinds of racial inequalities and sexual inequalities and gender inequalities. And there's so many inequalities. There's tons of them. And if the more that you fit into the inequality categories, these are the intersectionality where you can be a black female who is handicapped and happens to be left-handed and gay. If you have all these things stacked into you, you're the one of the most oppressed. But the ones that are the most privileged are the rich male, white male, right? They're in the category of being the oppressor because they have all the supposed advantages. But really what they're doing, they're not seeking real justice, that the rich and poor are treated equally and fairly by the law, where Lady Justice is blind. The key is not to be blind, but the key is to take the blindfold off and make sure that that we treat the privilege harsher and with more severity than we treat the underprivileged. And that's going to balance the scales of equality. But if you really want to play that out, think about a basketball game where you give us white men that can't jump more playing time to compensate for our inabilities. Now that would be applied social justice in sports. But the problem with sports, it's constantly telling us that their view of justice doesn't work. The best players play more. And it's not for everybody to win, it's for someone to win and someone to lose. But what is just is the referees to call it fair. I'm almost certain that Alabama gets all the calls when they play Arkansas. But no, if we really wanted social justice, Alabama would give us your coach, you know, for a couple years to level the playing field. Listen to what the UCLA School of Public Affairs says about critical race theory. Critical race theory recognizes that racism is ingrained in the fabric and in the system of the American society. The individual racist needs not exist to note the institutional racism is pervasive in the dominant culture. This is the analytical lens that critical race theory uses in examining existing power structures. Critical race theory identifies that these power structures are based on white privilege and white supremacy, which perpetuates the marginalization of people of color. So it's not about you being an active racist. It's that you participate in a society that's systemically racist. And therefore, this is why they say silence is violence. You may say, well, I'm not a racist. Well, it doesn't matter. You are. And if you don't speak up against racism in society, and if you're not pro-Black Lives Matter, and if you're not actively seeking to deconstruct the power structures of white man so that you can give it to those who are underprivileged, you are part of the system. D'Angelo says the worst thing you could be is a happy housewife. You're perpetuating this power structure, and you're part of the problem. You say, well, I'm happy. I'm satisfied in this position. I love this position. I'm enjoying this position. They go, no, you're the problem because you're teaching that to your children. You're teaching that to your daughters. And we're not going to have liberation of women as long as you're silent and you're going along with these power structures. That's why it's not sufficient for you to say you're not racist. You have to be what you call anti-racist. It's not about being neutral or unbiased or unprejudiced. So they're changing the word justice from just treating everybody the same to justice becomes, social justice becomes about equal distribution of power. Ultimately, it's about power and authority. And what happens if you take power? You know, we can think about money, and that's, you know, communism and Marxism, take money and just equally dispense it out. But really, social justice is about power, where you equally disperse power or authority across everybody, children to everybody. What do you have? Everybody gets to do what's right in their own eyes, and there's no authority. Now, we know theoretically that this can't function. The only way this can function if you have a replacement of God. And the only way that can happen is if you have a dictator. Practically, it leads to, and I think it leads to a one-world government, a dictator trying to make this, to be able to carry out this vision. And so what you end up getting, you rather get a loving God that gives individual rights and responsibilities and freedoms and the infrastructure of society that we can function together and work in harmony together, where rich and poor can work together, because it's not about, our happiness is not about our possessions. Because what's ultimate is not matter. It's not something physical. It's not power. It's not like submission is evil in God's system. I'm convinced that God's part of God's glory. Some of God's glory is the fact that He is God and He rules over all things and everything's underneath Him. That there is some glory in the fact that He is God. But there's another part of His glory that He is glory because He is humble. Think of Philippians chapter 2. That this is part of who God is. This is part of His disposition. Though He was equal with God in the form of God, He didn't think it was robbery to be equal with God. He didn't grasp after that, but willingly, the second person of the Trinity, willfully and willingly come underneath and took a submissive role and put away His glory. And when you look at the humility of God in the person of Jesus Christ, when I look at that, and I go, man, that is glorious. That is spectacular. That God is God, but He also is humble and He's willing to be submissive. I can't think of any more glory than that, that God is both ands. That is truly glorious, but the world doesn't see that because of sin has blinded them to the glory of submission and the glory of that. So the world is flipped everything around because of sin. Now, let me close real quickly with the time we have left. Is that social justice is political activism. It's not just an ideology that they're content to theoretically believe. It's not like Platonism or Aristotelianism that's good in the academy. Social justice is a philosophy that has to be implemented. It's a religion. It's a religion that has to be enacted. And if you want to know the methods in which they're trying to enact it, just read Saul Alinsky's book, Rules for Radicals. And he basically says, because we don't believe in absolutes, any means is a good means. The end justifies the means. His ethics, he says, to me, ethics is doing what is best for the most. So the end justifies the means. He says, in war, anything is acceptable. You know, you think about, you're in a war, you can lie, you can cheat, you can kill. In war, you throw away a lot of the things you would do outside of war. Saul Alinsky says, we're at war with the power structures that are ruling over us. We're at war with that, and we have to deconstruct that. So any means is possible. He's the one that says, don't waste a good crisis. Radicals must have a degree of control over the flow of events. D'Angelo says the key to reconstructing this utopia of division of power, where everybody gets to do what's right in their own eyes, the way of doing that is you've got to deconstruct all the institutions that God has established, all the institutions of power. She says, if tomorrow only women were appointed to government, they could not govern outside the rules that men had established. To reshape the institutions and its norms and practices would take generations of effort. And because language is the problem, language is a method of power, then they have to redefine language. And this is their main weapon, is controlling the narrative. Redefining terms. James Lindsay says, if knowledge is a construct of power which functions through ways of talking about things, knowledge can be changed and power structures can be toppled by changing the way we talk about things. Thus, applied postmodernism focuses on controlling discourses. This is, we know it as political correctness. Get people where they can't say certain things because it's not politically correct. And by changing the narrative, this is cancer culture. The way of doing this, according to Saul Alinsky, is you've got to stir up discord. People are not going to want change until they realize they're miserable in the state that they're in. And the worst thing that can happen is, like you said, have a happy, content housewife who's happy in that state. If people are satisfied, if the black community is content, if black people say, oh, racism is gone, and they feel like everything is good and improving, then we're not going to make change. So we have to stir up division. And we got to classify people, not into unifying things. Like, we have to be Arkansans and Alabamians. We can't just be Americans that would unify us. We have to be black. We have to be white. We have to be handicapped. We have to be healthy. We have to be male. We have to be female. We've classified into these 100 different classifications. And then you've got to get people to think according to their class. This is called groupthink. Get people to think, I'm a black man before I'm American. Or I'm a black woman before I'm a human being. Get people to think in their individual segment, and then stir up discontentment that they're oppressed and things are not right for them, and that they have to, everything they do has to be in favor of advancing their little subclass. So you have to stir up difficulties and animosity. By doing this, you know, you're creating class warfare purposefully. And that's why it seems like now race relations are worse than they were 20 years ago. But that's intentional. Everything's about race. Even the police, statistics doesn't show that black males are being targeted. The facts don't bear that out. But it would seem that way because anytime there is a black male that's shot, and I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but anytime that is, that's the story for the next 6 months. That's the narrative. And it paints the picture that the average police officer is racist just by the fact that he's a police officer. They're changing how people think by controlling the narrative and stirring up strife and discord. They're even doing this on a national level where it's going to be where it's racist to be pro-American, to be proud to be an American, especially if you're from the South, proud to be from the South. So this is the objective of social justice, is to attack the institutions that God has established, the family, the individual, and the state. And this is why, in conclusion, I believe this is an anti-God ideology, an anti-God philosophy. And as we know, it's everywhere we look. We're at war. And but as I kind of concluded last night, I'll wait to say my conclusion into my sermon on how we're to combat this, the mission of the church. Did I take questions, sort of?